And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is the very well-known Hugh McKay, who is the author of a new book, The Therapist. Hugh McKay is a social psychologist and a best-selling author. Hugh is a Fellow of the Australian Psychological Society and was appointed an Officer of the Order of Australia in 2015. Hugh has a number of honorary doctorates from Charles Sturt University, Macquarie University, the University of New South Wales, University of Western Sydney, and the University of Wollongong, as well as the Hartnett Medal from the Royal Society of Arts and the Alumni Award for Community Service from the University of Sydney. It might surprise some people to know that The Therapist is Hugh's ninth novel because he is so well known for his social commentary on Australian life in books such as Australia Reimagined, which we spoke about on this program in 2018. Hugh, welcome back to Dads on the Air.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's lovely to be here.
Hugh, after writing so many non-fiction books around your life's work, why a novel?
I've always wanted to write fiction, strangely enough. I wrote a couple of novels in my 20s, which fortunately were never published. It would have been embarrassing, I think. But I don't actually draw a big distinction between, this may sound odd, but I don't draw a big distinction between the non-fiction and the fiction. What I'm trying to do always is help us all try to understand ourselves and each other a little bit better. And with my social research, Bill, such as Australia Reimagined, the book we talked about last time, that was, in a way, I suppose, sort of holding up a mirror to Australia and saying to Australians, can you see yourself in this picture? You know, this is my analysis of what's going on in Australia at the moment. Well, now with fiction, I'm sort of doing the same thing, only obviously not on the big picture, but in the miniatures of individuals and personal relationships and the character of a small group of individuals who populate the novel. But because I've spent most of my working life sitting in people's lounge rooms and kitchens and on their back verandas listening to them telling me the story of their life or their views about politics or parenting or gender or money or whatever it might be, all that stuff is permanently with me. So when a story comes to mind and seems to be worth writing, it comes straight out of my imagination. But of course, my imagination is fed by all that research. So readers who are familiar with my nonfiction will, I think, when they read The Therapist, will recognize that there are some themes that are sort of echoes of some of the things I've been saying in my non-fiction. But the other thing to be said about it, Bill, is that writing fiction is very liberating for someone who's been a serious researcher all my working life. And when I write non-fiction, I have to justify every sentence and it's all got to be absolutely right. It's wonderful to be let off the leash and just let the imagination run. And interestingly, since we're with Dads on the Air, one of the themes that emerged, which I didn't really expect to emerge when I started writing The Therapist, but concerning several characters in the book, is the whole issue of paternity and fatherhood and how good we are or not good at being fathers. So that's quite an important theme that runs through the book.
Yes, there are lots of paternity issues raised in the book and at different stages of people's lives. And you've introduced the modern practice of sperm donation, which is very interesting to a lot of people.
Yes. One of the things the publisher said about this book when they accepted it for publication, they said they liked the fact that there are a lot of very contemporary issues in it, and that's certainly one. Yeah, who would have thought, you know, even 20 or 30 years ago, who would have thought that young couples would be saving up not for a deposit on a house, but for IVF treatment. But I hear people saying exactly that. It's a very expensive procedure. But yes, there's a very significant number of women who decide that they want to have a child, but they don't happen to have a partner at that time, and time is running out, as it is for Samantha, the young woman in the book, who's looking for the sperm donor. She's 40, and she knows she hasn't got much longer for fertility, so she doesn't happen to have a partner, but she wants to go ahead anyway. So her mother, who is the central character of the book, a psychotherapist called Martha Elliott, Martha is very nervous about all this, and she is a little more conventional in her attitudes and is very anxious about what her daughter is getting up to, while at the same time, of course, looking forward to being a grandmother. I mean, there's a lot of variation, of course, because we're in the middle of a big social change about all this, Bill, but now you have a legal right, I think, in all states, I'm not sure, to find out who the donor is, but it's up to individuals whether they make contact. Actually, I heard recently of a group of women with their children who were all the product of the same sperm donor. Once a year they have a picnic, which they call their dibblings party. And yeah, dibblings is a word I haven't encountered before, but this is donor siblings. So they all have the same father, but I don't know who the father is. But all they know is that it was the same sperm donor, so they get together and have their dibblings picnic.
Yes, it's a new world, isn't it? But
yeah, yeah.
Well, so in your book, we do get to go inside the psychotherapist's office and find out what people are actually paying for. What do you see as the difference between, say, a psychotherapist and a counsellor?
It's a very tricky question, that one, because in common usage, we say clinical psychologist, psychotherapist, counsellor, and they're almost interchangeable terms. I mean, my personal psychological hero, an American psychologist called Carl Rogers, who's written a number of books and created a whole new school of psychotherapy. So he was a psychologist, but he preferred just to call himself a counsellor. Just yesterday I was talking to some people about the new book, and a member of the audience is a psychotherapist who said she is not a clinical psychologist, and she thinks it's very important for people to make the distinction between a clinical psychologist, who is a person registered. I mean, I'm not a clinical psychologist, but I'm a registered psychologist. You can't call yourself a psychologist in Australia without being registered with the appropriate health authority, even if you're a social psychologist, social researcher like me, if I want to use that word. But the theoretical or the strict distinction is that clinical psychologists they're qualified in psychology and they are registered, and that's Martha in the book. She's a registered clinical psychologist, and then there are other people who aren't registered as psychologists who can still call themselves. Anyone can call themselves a psychotherapist. Mm. You don't have, because that's not a registered category, you don't have to have a particular qualification. Similarly, counsellor. I mean, a lifeline counsellor, for example, will be trained in telephone counselling but won't be a registered psychologist. But all these distinctions are a bit blurry, Bill, because some of my friends who are clinical psychologists call themselves psychotherapists because people sort of understand that term. That's kind of like the umbrella term. But if you want to be strict, that's the strict difference. The psychotherapist is not necessarily qualified or registered as a psychologist.
It's a strange one because the psychotherapist actually sounds a bit more impressive than a psychologist.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why some of my friends choose that term, although Martha in the book just calls herself. Well, she's a bit of an odd one. She calls herself a psychologist, but she does things which actually would have got her deregistered in reality, because she started to incorporate, with her female clients, she started to incorporate foot massage as part of the therapy, and she does guided meditation and deep breathing exercises and so on. But as you say, in about half the book is her at work. So we meet four or five of her clients and get to know their story quite intimately in the consulting room. And the other half of the book is really Martha's private life and the private life of her professional colleague and, of course, her daughter and the hunt for sperm donor.
I guess there are a number of messages. I mean, one message I particularly liked at one stage where you say that we should all have a serious reflection on our own life relationships, our dreams, the source of happiness or disappointments, and how we are going in general. Is that what you're trying to get across in the book?
Yes, I think. I mean, I hope that the book will reveal to people the great benefit of spending a bit of time with a therapist. Some of us can achieve that with a partner or close friends or just personal reflection. But I do think all of us need regular periods of reflection just to consider how we're travelling and whether we're becoming the sort of person we want to be, and also to reflect on our stumbles and our frailties and the mistakes. We've all made lots of mistakes, so that we can think about how that happened and even were we kind enough yesterday, that sort of reflection. I think it is extremely healthy for us. We're social animals. We need interaction with each other in order to stay mentally and emotionally strong and healthy. But we also need quiet times of solitude and reflection, almost to recharge the batteries, you know, to get our resources together for the pretty demanding business of being a human being.
Well, I guess there was a stigma at one stage about going to see a psychologist or a psychotherapist or even a counsellor, but I think those days have gone now, because maybe it's to do with the widespread depression in society that people feel it's quite normal now, don't they, to get some treatment?
Yes. This is, I think, a really central point, Bill, because you're absolutely right. If you go back a generation, to say that you were seeing a psychologist, people would raise their eyebrows. I think, you know, what are you, nuts? But now, well, the truth about use of counselling and psychotherapy services is the demand has never been heavier. And in fact, one psychologist in three in Australia has closed their books because they just can't cope with any more patients or clients, some of them call them. The demand is so heavy. And you're right, of course. What's changed is that it's the sort of thing we talked about last time we were talking. That's now a while ago. I don't expect listeners to remember that. But we're talking about a period in our society's kind of social evolution where epidemics of mental illness were inevitable. And when I say that, I mean, if you look at what's been happening to us over the last 30 or 40 years, we've made some very significant decisions about how we're going to live without always understanding what the consequences of those decisions might be. And I'll give some examples in a moment. But if you put these choices together and look at the trends that have been fed by these choices, what you're looking at is a series of trends that erode our social cohesion, that make us more socially fragmented. Just very quickly, Bill, I'll just run through a few things, what I'm talking about. Things like our shrinking households. Every fourth household in Australia now contains just one person. And we're heading for a situation probably within the next 15 years or so where it'll be every third household contains just one person. If you put single-person and two-person households together, that accounts for about 53 or 54% of all Australian households. Now, that doesn't mean that all people who live alone or in two-person households are socially isolated or lonely or anything, but it does mean that the risk of people being more socially isolated has been greatly increased through that shrinkage of our households. Another factor is our high rate of relationship breakdown. A lot of fractured families, and that contributes to social fragmentation. Between 35 and 40% of contemporary marriages will end in divorce, so that's a huge contributor. If it's just two people, well, that's a two-person household, at least for a while, becomes to single-person households. If kids are involved, it's even more complicated. Then there are things like our increased mobility, where we're now moving house, just like Americans, actually. We're moving house on average once every 6 years. So there's a lot of people moving in and out of local neighbourhoods and communities. We're not as settled as we used to be. And, of course, we're more mobile also, in the sense that we have almost universal car ownership. Most of us live in drive-in, drive-out suburbs where you wave at your neighbour's car. You know, you assume the neighbour's driving, but it's very different from the days when there was more footpath traffic. In fact, in some new housing developments, particularly in our outer suburbs, the developer doesn't even put in a footpath because everyone's using their car. So it's another factor. And, of course, you'd have to mention our busyness. We're all so busy, and busyness is an enemy of social cohesion. It sort of, you know, neighbours are having drinks tomorrow, Bill, you're coming? No, no, too busy. And also our enthusiastic embrace of information technology is in some ways the biggest of all the changes, because it's meant that many of us are trading off face-to-face time with eye contact, which is the crucial ingredient in human relationships, making eye contact with each other. That's what neuroscientists tell us. Well, we're trading a lot of that off in favour of screen time, and we're suffering as a result of that. We're suffering what actually a Melbourne clinical psychologist, Michelle Lynn, describes as social hunger. If you don't have enough face-to-face time each day, this can have a negative effect, rather like physical hunger. We get cranky and irritable and even angry without knowing why. So I won't go on with all that, Bill, but you put all that stuff together and you're looking at a society which is much more fragmented. And many Western societies are the same, but a society that is much more fragmented than we used to be. And when herd animals, which is what we are, feel a bit cut off from the herd, when the herd starts to disperse a bit, the consequences for us are quite serious. And the obvious consequences are increased loneliness. In fact, in a survey before the pandemic hit, it emerged that 25%, I find this a very sad statistic, but 25% of Australian adults report feeling lonely most of the time. And that figure gets well above 30% for the loneliest group in our society, who are the 18 to 25-year-olds, who are, of course, our heaviest users of social media. So that's that screen time problem. So loneliness has become an epidemic. Anxiety and depression are also now in epidemic proportions. So those are the consequences of becoming a quite different kind of society. Hence, people feeling a bit more cut off, the rise of individualism, which is very unhealthy for us since we are members of a social species, and the consequence, it's a long way round for this conclusion, but the consequence is very huge, huge increase in demand for psychotherapy, counselling, clinical psychology.
It reminds me of a line from Crocodile Dundee, where one of the characters said to Hoag he was going to see a psychologist, and Hoag said, "What's the matter? Don't you have any mates?" Sums it up, I think.
Well, it's actually an interesting point. I mean, there are times when even people who are in a loving family and have a good circle of friends nevertheless do need professional help to sort out something that's bothering them, or to deal with grief or suffering or some other difficulty that they're facing. But generally speaking, I mean, there's a lot of wisdom in that line, because when we are more socially cohesive, when we do know our neighbours and we're interacting and we're part of the herd, our psychological problems are likely to be less. Certainly we're not going to have the loneliness problems that arise from social isolation so often. And loneliness we now recognise as a disease, because it's not only associated with anxiety and depression, but also with hypertension, inflammation, disturbed sleep, vulnerability to addiction, even reduced life expectancy is associated with feelings of loneliness. So it's a serious problem. And I think, yeah, I mean, Mick Dundee is telling us something we need. If we need to be a bit more vigilant, I think. We need to be a bit more conscientious about our obligations to our friends and neighbours to make sure we are there for them. I think another reason why there's been such a spike in demand for psychotherapy is that we're in danger of losing the art of listening. Bill, I mean, you're a superb listener. But generally speaking, people have become more impatient, a bit less inclined to give themselves to the act of listening. Empathic, attentive listening is a therapeutic gift that we give each other, because we all need to be listened to. We all need to be noticed and acknowledged and taken seriously.
Do you admire any of the characters in your book?
I do. In fact, generally speaking, I love them all, Bill. There's a couple, I won't say too much about them, but Abigail Wharton and her husband Bill. I mean, I like Bill, but Abigail is a bit hard to take, and she's a very, very difficult client. She's a client who confronts Martha with the proposition that if you're going to be a therapist, then your own life had better be in order. You know, it's all very well being good at your job, but are you good at your life? You know, we don't want to go to an obese GP who tells us we've got to lose weight. That would be hypocritical. Well, we don't want a hypocritical psychotherapist. So that's skating on a bit of thin ice for Martha. But I love Martha. I think Martha, she's had her problems. She's been through some very turbulent periods in her personal life. But I think of Martha as a really good person who's utterly devoted to helping troubled clients deal with their difficulties. She's a very profoundly caring person. I feel as if I know her. It's very odd. I feel as if I saw her in the street, I'd recognize her. But so I love her. And the other clients, apart from the difficult one that I mentioned, there's a Hazel who's approaching 80, a widow, lives alone. When Martha gives her a foot massage, she says that's the first time anyone's touched her in about 3 years. You know, there are a lot of people in that situation, and my heart bleeds for Hazel. All the clients I really like. I feel, I mean, it probably sounds silly because I sort of invented these characters, but once they come out of the imagination, they do develop a kind of a sort of life of their own. The conversations take turns that I didn't think they were going to take when I started writing the book, but I warmed to all of them, and I felt that I understood why they were troubled. For example, one young woman is there because her husband is in therapy, and he doesn't want to talk to her about what's going on. He won't say why he went to see a therapist. He won't say what he talks about to the therapist, and she feels very excluded. And I've heard other people say that. It's very tough being the partner of a person seeing a psychotherapist who doesn't want to talk about it. And so Martha is helping this young woman to have a slightly different perspective on that. And that particular subplot turns out very well in the end. But it's a lot of pain for people who feel as though there's some deeply private stuff being discussed with a therapist, which even the wife doesn't know about. Another theme, I suppose, which comes out of these people, and it's a thing that worries Martha, and it's worried me all my working life as a social researcher as well, which is how much of the story are you really getting? You know, when clients are there for their 50-minute session, they give you their side of the story, and perhaps, as in the case of that young woman whose husband is seeing the therapist, Martha doesn't hear his side of the story. And as a social researcher, I always wonder, you know, is there more I should be picking up here? Am I missing something? In fact, Martha says at one point, reflecting on this, she says that when a client leaves the office, she often feels like saying to the empty room, "Yes, and what else?" And she says, "I sometimes feel as if I'm being overwhelmed by all the things I don't hear." And I can sympathise with that. But no, back to your central question, I've felt more warmly towards the characters in this book because they are all very frail humans, flawed, frail humans, who are trying to do their best, who are really trying to sort things out and get back on an even keel.
At one stage, Martha describes what she'd like as her epitaph, and she said, she heard me. I think my mother's epitaph she wanted was, she tried. Do you have a particular epitaph?
Well, I do, actually. Somebody recently said to me, oh, you're the bloke who explains us to ourselves. And I thought, gee, that's all right. Mm. That's music to the ears of a social researcher. If people feel as if I've helped to explain them to themselves, that's about as good as it gets. And in a way, you know, that's back to an earlier point, Bill, that's the link between my nonfiction and my fiction. I hope my nonfiction helps explain us to ourselves. And in this novel, I hope people coming out of the novel, they might identify with some characters more than others, but what they're getting a glimpse of is humanity in the raw. And I hope that is illuminating. I hope people come away from the book feeling as though, well, two things really, feeling as though they do understand themselves a bit better by having spent such intense periods with these other people, especially Martha, but also that inspired by Martha's example, we might all feel a little bit more kindly disposed towards people we encounter, a bit more patient with other people, a bit more tolerant, a bit more willing to listen, following Martha's example.
It's been so fascinating speaking with you today, Hugh McKay, the author of a new book called The Therapist. We've run out of time. We didn't even get time to play your choice of a song, so listeners will have to do it themselves. It was All You Need Is Love by the Beatles. Now, if any of the listeners would like to listen to this show again, you can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to make a comment or any questions on this particular show, and you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So it just remains for me now to give a special thank you. Hugh McKay, thank you very much for being a guest once again on Dads on the Air.
It's been a great pleasure. Always enjoy talking to you. Thanks very much, Bill.
Thank you, and we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.